Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrise, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest today is poet and essayist Eula Biss, author of Having and Being Had, out today from Riverhead Books. You might recognize the name. Biss is the author of the New York Times bestseller On Immunity and the National Book Critics Circle Award winner Notes from No Man's Land, American Essays. And her first book, The Balloonists, from 2002, was, as stated in her official Northwestern University faculty biography, quote, written in prose, published as poetry, and reviewed as both fiction and memoir. Having and Being Had is similarly irreducible, an exquisite essay collection that considers the trappings of American affluence. Biss is an artist in residence at Northwestern, married to another faculty member, they have a son, and in 2015, they bought their first home outside Chicago, which more or less solidified their standing in the established middle class. This is from our starter view, which begins with a quote from the book. My adult life, I decide, can be divided into two distinct parts, the time before I owned a washing machine and the time after, writes Biss. She means it. Acquiring a home and its attendant creature comforts has radically changed her relationships to money, labor, and domesticity. In the same way her previous books explored the hidden social contracts around racism and vaccination, her latest interrogates capitalism's relationship to upper-middle-class living, particularly hers. Most of the brief, potent essays consider particular objects and actions and the questions they spark about value. End quote from our review, once again. Enthusiastically starred review. We are going to talk about particular objects and actions and questions and value soon. But first, a word from one of our sponsors for this episode, Amazon Crossing, about the memoir A Drop of Midnight. Born to interracial American parents in Sweden, Jason Diakite grew up between worlds, part Swedish, American, Black, White, Cherokee, Slovak, and German, riding a delicate cultural and racial divide. It was a no-man's land that left him in constant search of self. Even after his hip-hop career took off, Jason fought to unify a complex system of family roots that branched across continents, ethnicities, classes, and eras to find a sense of belonging. What he found was a story only he can tell. Read or listen to Jason Diakite's moving memoir, A Drop of Midnight, for free with Amazon Prime. Visit amazon.com/adropofmidnight. And now, let's talk with Eula Biss, author of Having and Being Had. Welcome, Eula, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I am just beside myself with glee that we get to discuss this brilliant book. But first, before we get into the book per se, I thought, though I'd argue this topic has a lot to do with what you're writing about in these essays, I wanted to mention the NBA strike. Last night, the Milwaukee Bucks did not play their scheduled playoff game against the Orlando Magic in protest of the shooting of Jacob Blake by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot going on there, but there's a specific inroad I'd like to take with you, which is your collection reinforces the importance of words. Did you see that some outlets were using the word boycott while others were hitting back with the word strike?
No, I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, okay. I'm wondering about it because I think it plays into ideas of work, entertainment, capital, economy, and like just initial impression. To your mind, what's the difference? Is there a quibble there with calling what the basketball players are doing a boycott versus calling it a strike?
So I'm out of my depth here because I couldn't be less well-versed in the world of sports, but it seems to me, from my very on the margins view of that whole world, mm-hmm. that there has been a long time resistance to treating and respecting players as workers, right? Mm-hmm. It's in the past, especially around Colin Kaepernick's actions, I saw a lot of people implying that he was lucky to be doing what he was doing and to regard himself as a worker or somebody with rights to protest was there was something wrong with that.
Right.
So I'd suspect that that attitude is still here, right?
And it's interesting because the New York Times was writing about it today and they had a few points in there and they said the owners of the teams support the strike. And I was like, huh, what a funny thing mm-hmm. to include, first of all, and what a funny idea that mm-hmm. that the owners would support the workers not working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Though we're in a strange space where their work isn't always seen as work. And
right.
are they workers? Are they entertainers? Are they playing? You know, I really connect to this problem as an artist whose work right. is not really always seen as work. I did wonder to myself, you know, on the women's strike, the day of mm-hmm. the women's strike, what it would mean for me to strike and what aspect of my work I should cease to do and who it would hurt or help if I, for instance, didn't do my writing that day or didn't show up as a teacher that day.
Right. It's interesting because this idea of getting the gift of being able to work in a certain capacity that can be seen as your joy, you know, you have your dream job, right? But it's still a job at the end of the day. You know, like even I, as a journalist who gets to interview authors full time, you know, there's always this sort of, you know, nagging presence at the back of my mind that, you know, there are so many people who would step up to do your job if you were to strike, if you were mm-hmm. to quit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. And that is historically what prevents many people from striking, is this sense that they will be swiftly and replaced. And sometimes that threat is real and sometimes it's imagined. And yeah, I've experienced that in my own workplace as a teacher, this sense that, oh, there's a lot of writers in Chicago. And if these writers don't want to do this job, somebody else will. But it's a little trickier to think about that in terms of one's work as an artist. I think you'd like to believe as an artist that nobody could do what you were doing except for
right.
you, right?
Mm-hmm.
which may or may not be true, but...
right. Well, another thing that this collection illuminates for me is like how, well, first of all, it reminds me of how associative cultural criticism is. And not to speak too personally, but I have a wife. She's a high school English teacher and she teaches media literacy to her students.
Mm.
And the way she teaches criticism, like just the inkling baby first lesson of criticism, is she likens it to hyperlinking or to a matching game. And it's like when we build out this idea into like my reading of your book at the end, especially in the notes, you point to this wide web of associative of minds. You say that your friends gave you a lot of the, you know, the material or the books or the articles you read that like richly inform some of the essays in this collection. So really, you're not alone.
No, not at all. And in this book, I was really trying more than in anything I've ever written. I was trying to expose and show the web of people, thoughts, books, experiences that inform the artwork and not hide that and not hide behind the illusion of the singular artist creating a singular work. I think in part because I was thinking about various different kinds of economy when I was writing this, and particularly this idea of the gift economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about how I'm always writing from a sort of gift economy. I get given ideas, questions, specific readings from friends, neighbors, students, family members, you know, there's a wide range of people in my life. And in my past writing, I will occasionally nod to that. There'll be a line like, my sister says, or something like that. But in this work, I wanted to really have that, what is usually the kind of invisible inner workings of the way the work is put together. I wanted to make that visible, show the wires, I guess.
You ever play Tetris?
Yes, so long ago, but yes.
me too. Like what you just said just popped this intense piece perfectly into my thinking. I'm identifying myself as like a really intense New York Times reader, but on August 20th, in the By the Book column, the fantastic novelist, Yah Jessie, she was the subject of By the Book, and she names you in the list of amazing authors and critics who inform her work.
Ah, that's so flattering.
And furthermore, they asked her the question, what was the last book you read that made you furious? Can I read you just the beginning of this response?
Yeah.
I've been so furious these past few months. The enormity of the losses that we are seeing right now of lives, of jobs, of housing, of safety, of civil liberties is infuriating because things were already so brutal for so many, and the fallout from this will only further brutalize. It never had to come to this. I am thinking of Eula Biss's On Immunity, where she writes, quote, however we choose to think of the social body, we are each other's environment. That's pretty great.
Totally. Yeah, I love that she took that quote too. And it can be something that's hard to remember, that we are each other's environment, and that we're so trained into thinking of ourselves as singular individuals who live in our own capsules. But yeah, it's very evident right now. Actually, the pandemic has, you know, in some ways underscored this, that even if you're living alone in your house and not interacting directly with people, that life is having an effect on other people. You're drawing resources, and other people are out exposing themselves to illness in order to support your life.
Right, right. Yeah, Jessie put it so well. You put it so well in that quote from On Immunity. Is it fair to say vis-a-vis having and being had that we are each other's economy?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, as I was thinking about the various economies in my life, as I wrote this book, I really felt that the people in my life, my communities, are my richest economy, and my richest resource. It's the book kind of refocused me on the tremendous importance of that kind of exchange, the exchange between people, you know, and that's one of the things that economy is damaged by things like racism that degrade the quality of exchange and that force people out of connection and that damage the social fabric. So I feel very strongly that there's wounds and damage done to my most precious resource by things like racial oppression.
Right. You wrote a piece for the Times Magazine in 2015, White Debt, about buying your house. It's the house you still live in, right?
Yes.
And your house has a twin. Okay.
Yeah.
Would you tell us a little bit about this and what kind and whether you're in conversation with the inhabitants of your house's twin?
Yes, I am. My next door neighbors live in a house that is very nearly identical to my house. These houses were built in the 30s by brothers, and neither of those brothers are living any longer. But it's very moving to me that I live in the sibling house of my neighbor's house. And my next door neighbor actually just passed away. Two weeks ago. So very recently. But I had many conversations with him before he passed about his life in this town where we live. And he attended the same elementary school that my son attended, but spoke of his experiences there, which were quite different than my son's experiences. He was beaten on the playground for being an African-American student at that school. He was discouraged from talking to white women, he went on to return to this place in his adulthood and work as a postal worker, where he had, it sounded to me like an endless array of racist encounters with the people he delivered mail to. So yeah, the stories that he told me from that sibling house across the fence were really instructive to me.
One difference in the siblings is your attic is finished and the other was unfinished, correct?
Yeah, and so that's one of the conversations I had with my next door neighbor that really made an impression on me was the attic of my house was refinished by the previous owners. So we moved into a house that already had this refinished attic. And it's a useful space for me. It's where I am right now. I'm doing this interview from the attic. It's where I do my writing. Both my husband and I have desks up here. It's where we store all our books. And it also, in this time, in this pandemic time, it's what makes it possible for us to both be working from home and have a child downstairs who's doing middle school from home. But my next door neighbor was interested in this. He asked me about the finished attic, and I described it to him. And he said, oh, yeah, I would love to do something like that to my attic. And this is somebody who, by the way, was significantly older than me and had been working a full-time job since before I was born and working for the post office. And so a solidly employed middle-class Black person. And he was talking about, you know, very briefly, he didn't dwell on this, but he mentioned that he would love to have refinished his attic, but he didn't have the money. And then he said that is a very brief aside that part of the reason he didn't have the money was that most of his excess money went to supporting the families of people in his extended family who were in prison. It was a moment in which I was reminded of the tremendous draw that the prison system has on Black communities and Black wealth and Black families. So here's someone there's no one in his immediate family who's in prison, but he's still very financially impacted by imprisoned family members.
Yeah. And the more you get to know people on a personal level, the more your concept of a system expands. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the one thing that interpersonal connection is the one thing I feel that keeps it from really becoming truly overwhelming. Mm-hmm. You know, without that, if we're just to consider a system, it seems almost unintelligible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it does seem unintelligible, or it just, you know, without an understanding the system, it can also seem like a series of personal failures, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's actually how we're trained to see class and money in this country, as, you know, it's personal successes or personal failures. And if you do well, it's not because the system is expressly designed for you to do well, which is the case for me. And if you do badly, the idea is that, oh, well, you just didn't work hard enough. And I think that those ideas exist just to make us feel better about a system that, if we look at it for what it is unethical and unconscionable and kind of hard to live with in its real dimensions.
Right. But we comfort ourselves by saying, at least there are rules.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Though there's different rules for different people, as
right.
we know. And so it's, you know, so you can really pat yourself on the back for having, you know, followed an entirely different set of rules and had a different outcome than someone who is, who's really, you know, in some cases, not even really getting a chance to play the game.
Right. One terrible thing I've heard said about welfare recipients is they know how to, quote, work the system.
Mm.
But when we talk about using your money to hire enough lawyers to reason that you shouldn't have to pay taxes on billions of dollars in income, we don't call that working the system.
Right. Right.
You know.
Nor do we call our own middle class retirement accounts working the system. But
right.
I would say that making money through the stock market is definitely working the system. And, you know, as well as there's lots of wealthy people whose work, so to speak, is constituted almost entirely by making money off of money. And
right.
that would seem to be working the system and not really adding a tremendous value to society, in my opinion.
Right. And when I really just gaze into work the system as applied to a welfare recipient, I get even more uncomfortable because what does that mean? They have another child? Like, mm-hmm. like what is the intended meaning behind, like, what's the implication behind mm-hmm. that? It is really uncomfortable.
Right. And it would be much more accurate to say, here are people who've been failed by the system. And
right.
including and especially women who are doing the real work of caring for children, which is not compensated in under our system. And so if they're going to be parents to children and care for them, they can't simultaneously do that work and do other low-wage work and support those children. So often we're talking about single parents who need that support in order to do the work of parenting, which we don't tend to treat as work, think of as work, talk about as work, and we definitely don't compensate it as work.
Moreover, our talk about it is racialized. Proving that I do read things other than the Times, there's an article from Newsday in 2018, and just the title of it will tell you, Trump thinks only black people are on welfare, but really white Americans receive most benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's not surprising to me. Yeah.
No, and white Americans receive most benefits, I think, could be the title of a lot of articles.
Yes, totally. That's maybe the Onion headline we can just keep running for, you know.
You know, you have to laugh or you're going to cry, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. No, it's in general in this system and going back for hundreds of years, white Americans receive most benefits. But that isn't the way that white Americans tend to think about what they have. It's,
right.
You know, if the tendency is to think about what you have as the result of your own hard work. That was something I was trying to write myself out of. That mindset was something I was trying to write myself out of in this book. And actually, it's quite painful to write yourself out of
yeah.
that fantasy, right? I would love to believe that I have what I have because I worked hard.
Sure.
But I don't believe that to be true, though I've also worked hard, you know, and both mm-hmm. things can be true. You can have worked hard and also have essentially gotten handouts. And I think that that is, in my case, that's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. I have what I have because an unequal and highly unethical system has handed me a lot.
Right. So here's the unanswerable question, but maybe we could talk around it. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be a moral agent in the face of increasing inequality?
Yeah, I would love to be able to answer that.
You know,
that was the question that was really kind of haunting this book is, can I live in this class position and can I live a quote unquote good life? And by good life, I mean not just the comfortable life that I have, but a morally good life. And so again and again, I'm examining moments where I feel either morally compromised or there's some moral contradiction or my own sense of what is right or good is being violated, but by a decision that I myself made. And one such moment shows up on the very first page of the book. I write about, we just recently moved into this house, which is not a tremendously huge house by the standards of the place where I live. It's a two-bedroom house, but it has this finished attic, which expands it a bit. And we just moved in and we didn't really have any furniture left, or not left. We didn't have furniture yet. And a woman came to the door, rang the doorbell. She was a Mexican woman who had four children. And she asked me if she could rent our front room, which she could see from the street. And she could see from the street that it was empty because there weren't any curtains on the windows. And the room was completely empty. There was nothing in it. And it's a large room. And I told her that, no, she couldn't rent it because we were living in it. And that totally confused her. She was like, but it's empty. And and she was right. And it gave me a sense of how, you know, the excess of my own life. You know, here was, we'd been in the house a few months at that point. Here was a room that was entirely unused because we just hadn't gotten around to furnishing it yet. And I was in dialogue with someone who found that amount of space really desirable for a family of five, right? And we were a family of three who were simply not using it. And it really, it didn't feel right to me, right, that I had all this excess space when someone else in my neighborhood wanted just a tiny fraction of that space for her much bigger family.
Right. But we are held back from giving the gift of whatever excess resources we, you know, possess by what? By fear? By a rainy day? You know, like by a lack of, you know, like if that were a family member, perhaps you would have said, okay, you can crash here for a while. You know, like, is it a lack of, you know, like, you know, deep community bonds or like, I don't know. I don't have any answers, Eula.
Yeah. I don't really either. I don't specialize in answers if you haven't noticed, but I do, you know, in that moment, I did ask myself, why can't she live here? What's the reason? And the reason was because it's mine. And that kind of, I think that took me back to the fundamental, maybe the fundamental problem or not in our system. This current system of capitalism that we live within now is built on private property. And actually, it took a really long time to establish that because it's mine logic in people's minds and establish it so that it was accepted across a society. So there's I learned this as I started to research the history of capitalism and especially looking at the history of enclosure in England. So this is the process by which land that had been held commonly, so that was shared among common people, was made into private property. That process took a really long time, hundreds of years, in part because it was really actively resisted. And it didn't make sense to the common people of that time. So it's the logic that preceded because it's mine was a much more, it was the logic of everyone should have access to certain basic things that are necessary for life. So the logic of the commons was there will be shared grazing land because people need that in order to raise animals, and they need to raise animals in order to support their families. There was also a commons, there was actually a really intricate series of laws and practices that supported commoning, but they included the right to gather wood in forests that weren't yours. So you could gather firewood because it was recognized that, well, people need heat, right? So it's you need to be able to heat your home. And so it's your right to go into a forest that isn't yours and gather wood. There were rights to fishing, rights to gathering certain fruits and vegetables. There were rights to gleaning. So even if the fields that these crops were grown on didn't belong to you, you had the right to go in after they were harvested and take the things that the farmer had not taken. So this, you know, would be like a giant field of wheat has already been harvested, but much wheat is still left. And so usually it was women who gleaned, and they would go in and painstakingly pick up all the fallen wheat and feed a family off of that. So there's really all of this added up to rights to subsistence. And that is something that we seem to have lost in our current system. We don't actually recognize rights to subsistence. And that's what I think some systems in countries like, you know, Sweden or countries that have some democratic socialism, I think are trying to restore something like that, you know, basic rights to subsistence. That's It's also the logic behind the universal basic income, right? Is essentially the recognizing a right to subsistence, that everyone should have a baseline income and work from there.
Oh, I recently read a book called The Inner Level. It's by two English epidemiologists, and forgive me, I'll get listeners their names after our conversation wraps. But basically, they were saying, arguably, the United States is the most unequal country on the planet, and it is, in fact, making us sick, both rich and poor. If I'm reading it correctly, I believe the book suggests it's not that we have to understand the system or all of the social problems or have the right intentions behind progressive change. But if someone were just to sweep in and change the laws to make things more equal, then in 5, 10, 15 years down the road, we'd be a lot nicer to one another.
Mm, yeah. I do believe that it's bad. The inequality that we have is bad for everyone. It's mm-hmm. bad for the entire society. It's bad on both ends, even what would be called the winning end. But one of the disturbing things that I learned in researching this book and in reading about contemporary economics is that many economists do not consider inequality undesirable necessarily. It's not regarded as a problem or something to avoid by many economists. And even there's a long chapter in the beginning of Piketty's book, Capital in 21st Century, where he's kind of walking through the reasons why inequality might not be something a society wants. But he's not taking it as a given that we don't want inequality. It's, he's taking it as a given that actually we've accepted inequality. And it's, in some ways, we have built a system that was always going to produce this kind of inequality. And that was, I've seen quotes from economists, especially I think in the 80s, who knew that the policy decisions that were being made were going to produce greater inequality, but that was actually seen as a desirable outcome. You would have richer people and more inequality. So, but the thing that is, to my mind, empowering about this is that people made this system. It didn't, descend on us from above, fully formed. It wasn't handed to us by the gods or something like that. Yeah. We made the system, and it was particular policy decisions that have led to the kind of inequality that we have. And this system is made by people for people. So if it isn't what we want, we can change it. We can make the decisions that need to be made, the policy changes that need to be made to change it and to produce less inequality. It would be 1,000 little changes, but it's not fantasy. And there's a terrific book by a woman economist. I'm forgetting her name, but the book is called The Value of Everything. Mm. And one of her arguments is that we can have an economy in which we invest in the things that we say are valuable to us. So we say that education is valuable to us, but as a society, we don't really invest in education the way we invest in other things. But we could. And that would be a series of policy decisions.
Well, I could talk to you a million minutes more, but I see I've already taken more of your time than asked for. And I thank you for your generosity with me. So I will just say, is there anything else you'd like listeners of this conversation to know about your work, Freighted Word, or the book, or anything at all?
Oh, thank you. This was just such a pleasure. And I guess because you and I went into this, place of talking a little bit in the abstract, I guess I would just like to remind people that the book really doesn't deal with questions of inequality or the economy in the abstract. That was actually my primary project, was to make sure that the questions I was thinking about were always anchored in a lived life and in concrete moments, things, interactions. So just in case anyone's scared off by the abstractions.
Hopefully they're all enthralled and they will go pick up having and being had. Eula Biss, thank you so much for joining me today on Fully Booked.
Oh, thank you so much, Megan. It was my pleasure.
That was Eula Biss, author of Having and Being Had, an essay collection out today from Riverhead Books. And the authors of the book I mentioned in conversation with Eula are Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. Their book's full title is The Inner Level, How More Equal Societies Reduce Stress, Restore Sanity, and Improve Everyone's Well-Being. That one's from 2019, published by Penguin Press. After the break, we'll ask our editors for their top picks and books for the week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks and books for the week. We have nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau, fiction editor Lori Muchnick, and editor-in-chief Tom Beer this week. Young Readers editors Vicki Smith and Laura Simeon are out of the office. So, starting with nonfiction, what novelty? Eric, what's your choice?
My choice is a book called World of Wonders by Amy Nezuka Matatil. It is a book of essays. The subtitle is In Praise of Fireflies, Whale Sharks, and Other Astonishments. So it's a book of essays about the natural world. Most of them fairly short, and it's also has illustrations by Fumi Mini Nakamura. And it's just an amazing collection of, it celebrates the wonders of nature and some of the odder bits of nature, such as things like the comb jellyfish or the dancing frog, vampire squid, or the corpse flower, and the whale shark, which she actually spent a year studying. These are just beautifully written, joyful essays, kind of in the vein of Ross Gay. And it's, you know, our viewer closes with the line that says, the writing dazzles with the marvel of being fully alive. So it's just, especially during these times, this is something that it's a getaway, but it's just so beautifully written. And anybody who appreciates the natural world will find plenty to learn in here.
Eric, I'm excited to read this. You make it sound really interesting. And I love a poet who turns their hand to writing prose. I think they bring something special to it. And I think you sort of tipped your hand to what I was thinking of, which was Ross Gay. I was going to ask you if Ross Gay was sort of a comparable poet turned essayist.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was the first author that I thought of when I read this review and then started reading the book. And it also kind of serves as like a coming of age memoir for the author, who's a daughter of an Indian father and a Filipino mother. She kind of sought lessons early on how to adapt and protect herself. And she kind of shares that through these portraits of these really amazing creatures. And you're right, it's not easy to go from writing poetry to writing prose, but she does it very well.
This is perfect for this episode because, of course, our author interview guest is Eula Biss,
poet,
essayist extraordinaire. So
you
definitely tipped me over on this one. I'm going to pick up this book for real.
All right, great.
The book is World of Wonders, In Praise of Fireflies, Whale Sharks, and Other Astonishments by Amy Nezuka Matatil. Thank you, Eric, for that pick. Next, we've got Fiction with Lori. Lori, what's your choice?
Well, I am excited to be able to recommend the new Elena Ferrante book, The Lying Life of Adults. Not only has everybody been waiting for this for 5 years since she published The Story of the Lost Child, the last book in the Neapolitan quartet, but the book was originally supposed to come out last spring and the publisher postponed it. And I find it really heartwarming. They postponed it for the most delightful reason, which was, they say, because they wanted to help independent bookstores who were so instrumental in selling the Ferrante quartet. And they were afraid that if they published the book during the heart of the quarantine period, everybody would just be ordering the book from Amazon. So they held the book back to support independent bookstores. So if you're going to buy the book, I, you know, recommend you buy it from an independent bookstore.
That's amazing.
Isn't that interesting?
That's amazing. And that's a good power to have and to use.
Yeah. So anyway, this is another book about sort of preteen 12-year-old girl living in Naples. Her name is Giovanna. She lives in a more rarefied area of the city than Lena and Lenu in the earlier books. Her parents are both teachers, and they've kind of, you know, one generation earlier than the characters in the other books, rose out of poverty to become educated, and they have a upper middle class sort of lifestyle. And the book starts out, the very first line of the book is Giovanna saying something like, "My father said that I was ugly." And the whole book comes out of this statement, which after a while you find out he didn't actually say she was ugly. What he said to her mother when he thought she wasn't overhearing is that she was starting to resemble Vittoria, who is his sister, who they never see and they never talk about, but they sort of use her as an example in their family of someone who's just ugly and not a nice person, kind of ugly spiritually as well. And Giovanna is shattered by this, thinking that her father thinks she's ugly. And she, you know, she just gets it into her head in a way that preteens can, like, you know, what does my body look like? And how, you know, just, am I unattractive? And she starts trying to figure out, you know, what she looks like and what her personality is like. And then she decides she needs to go try to meet this Aunt Vittoria, who she has no memory of. So she starts trying to search out, and they never see her father's family at all. So she starts trying to find out things about them and goes looking for Aunt Vittoria. And of course, you know, untangles all kinds of family secrets and just kind of all the kind of great interpersonal dynamics and family background and lots of plot, just like all of Ferrante's most recent books. And, you know, it gets its hooks into you and you cannot stop reading it because it is so entertaining.
Thank you, Lori. I think I'm one of the only people on the planet who has not read her. And I assume I should start with the Neapolitan Quartet.
I would say so. Yeah. I wanted to wait to read the Neapolitan Quartet till she was finished with it, because I'd heard people saying it was hard. You know, they end with cliffhangers and it was hard to wait. So I did wait, but I wanted to read something by her. So I read one of her earlier books, The Days of Abandonment, which is also short. I thought, oh, I'll try this. And I actually didn't like it at all. And it's quite different from the Neapolitan Quartet. I mean, a lot of people do like it, but I didn't. I would start with the Neapolitan Quartet for sure.
Good to know. Thanks.
Lori's choice this week is The Lying Life of Adults by Elena Ferrante. Thank you, Lori, for that pick. And finally, we have Editor-in-Chief Tom Beer with a wild card pick. Tom, Tom, what's your pick?
Well, I'm going to go, Megan, with fiction this time. And I'm going to recommend a book called The Secret Lives of Church Ladies by Disha Filyaw. Full disclosure, Disha is a Kirkus reviewer and has written for us. And this book, that probably prompted me to pick it up, but I fell in love with it purely on its own merit. It's a collection of 9 stories. It's published by a university press, West Virginia University Press. And at this moment when so many of us are really trying to read more Black writers, this is a great collection to pick up and explore. They're all stories of girls, African-American girls and women, all of whom have some connection to the Black church, whether they are religious churchgoers or whether they have complicated relationships with their faith. In some cases, they are having affairs with the pastor or have crushes on the pastor's wife. And Disha just manages to write into these characters so completely. You believe in them. They're funny. They're messy sometimes, but they're really real. I think my favorite story is Peach Cobbler, which is about a girl whose mother is having an affair with the married pastor of their church. She refers to him as God because she thinks of him as being godlike. And this mother, who really kind of doesn't give her a lot of love or attention, feeds her TV dinners and whatnot, bakes a peach cobbler every time that the pastor comes over for them to have their affair. And it just taps into all of her jealousies and her feelings, and the story moves on to take some unexpected turns. But it's just a wonderfully written, closely observed, heartfelt debut collection, and I can't recommend it strongly enough.
I'm so excited about this one, Tom. I read a lot of it, not the whole thing, when we were working on our fall preview several months ago, and I've just been so excited for when it would come out so I could start recommending it to people. It's, you know, the stories just, you can read them very fast. They're written in a very kind of lucid style, and they're so enjoyable to read, but they're also kind of a quick read, and they just feel like something you can recommend to lots of people and they'll really enjoy it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, but the thing that I love that she does is the writing is very clear and simple in a lot of ways, but there's a lot of wisdom about the way people operate and their jealousies and their passions. And she really taps into that beautifully.
Yeah.
The name of this debut collection is The Secret Lives of Church Ladies by Disha Filia. Thank you, Tom, for that choice. Well, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. Please join us again next week. Very special week. Tom Beer will be interviewing Claudia Rankine, poet, essayist, playwright, and all-around fascinating conversational partner, about her new book, Just Us, An American Conversation. So you will not want to miss that. But until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.